They put Finley Campbell to rest on a quiet evening at his family mausoleum. It was raining, and not many came. There was Evangeline Schreck, of course, dressed in black, carrying flowers. Adrian Campbell, also in black, with the two children, Troilus and Cressida. And Robert Campbell, as head of the family. Not many mourners for a much misunderstood and maligned man. The vicar read quiet words from his Bible over a closed, empty coffin. No one ever found the body, but there was no doubt he was dead. A great many people saw him enter Tower Schreck, gun and sword in hand. The few guards he didn't kill left the burning tower at a run and spoke of a grim, determined figure heading into the heart of the flames, aimed like a bullet at Gregor Schreck's private quarters. One guard saw Finley break his way into that bloody sanctum. No one ever saw him come out. The fire gutted Tower Schreck from top to bottom, and most of the bodies were reduced to ashes by the intense heat. Everyone agreed that Finley Campbell was dead at last, and many heaved a sigh of relief. The Campbell Mausoleum had seen better times. A large stone structure without style or charm, centuries old, set in the middle of a lawn clipped with military precision, it looked like what it was, a secure place to store bodies. The thick stone walls were blackened and discolored here and there by fire, but the walls stood firm, and the locks and seals held, allowing the many generations of Campbell dead to rest undisturbed. Now Finley would rest there too, at least in spirit. Robert hadn't seen much point in a ceremony without an actual body to inter, but he could see it meant a lot to Evangeline, so he kept his peace and went along with it. Funerals were for the living, not the dead. Everyone knew that.
"Today we lay to rest a noble hero."
The vicar droned on, and the rain fell a little more heavily from the gray sky, pattering loudly on the closed lid of the coffin. Evangeline stared straight ahead, her mouth firm, her eyes dry. Adrienne stood beside her, veil lifted so she could sniffle quietly into a handkerchief. Her children stood wide-eyed on her other side, not really understanding, but for the moment overawed by the solemnity of the occasion. Robert pulled his cloak a little more tightly about him and watched raindrops fall from the wide brim of his hat. He never liked Finley and made no secret of the fact, but when all was said and done, the foppish killer had been family, so Robert had a duty to be there. The common word was that Finley had finally gone crazy and died taking out his old enemy, Gregor Schreck. No one knew what had fueled the open hatred between the two men, but there was no shortage of rumors, each one wilder than the last. The only thing they all agreed on was that no one at all missed Gregor Schreck. In fact, his death was greeted in all circles with the same concern as the sudden demise of a rabid dog. The social and political scene in the Parade of the Endless would be much quieter and safer for all concerned, with two such dangerous players gone. Evangeline looked down at the empty coffin and didn't cry. The vicar's quiet words washed over her, bringing no comfort. She'd always known Finley would die in combat, had already lived his death 100 times when he was late back from 100 impossible missions for the underground. She'd cried her tears then, and had none left now. It didn't help that their last meeting had ended in a quarrel, with raised voices saying terrible, unforgivable things. Or that Finley had gone to kill Gregor entirely because of what the Schreck had done to her. So in a sense, she had sent him to his death. Part of her had died with Finley, and sometimes she thought it was the best part. His was the only love she'd ever known, the only light in her short, dark life, and she didn't know what she would do with her life now. All she felt was an almost overpowering urge to take off the coffin lid, climb inside, and let them inter her in the Campbell Mausoleum. The best and brightest part of her life was over.
Et lux perpetua luceat eis.
The vicar finally ran down, made a hurried sign of the cross over the empty box, closed his Bible with a snap, and stepped back. His part in the service was over. Robert Campbell entered the secret identifying codes into the family crest on the mausoleum door, revealing only darkness within. He looked to Evangeline, who laid her flowers tenderly on the coffin lid, and then stepped back. The pre-programmed anti-grav sled under the coffin carried it slowly forward into the shadowy depths of the Campbell family crypt. And then the door closed firmly behind it. And that was that. Service over, goodbye said, time to get on with your lives. Whatever was left of them. Adrienne wiped her eyes.
I always cry at funerals. And weddings. The ceremonies appeal to my dramatic side. I always said I'd dance and cheer at Finley's funeral. But now he's gone. And I miss him. No one else ever stood up to me the way he did. Looking back, most of my life seems to have been a reaction to what he did and didn't do. Who am I going to find to fight with now? Who else is strong enough for me to sharpen my claws on? Oh, Evie. I never realized how important he was to me until he wasn't there anymore.
It was good of you to come. He always admired your strength and your courage.
Oh, don't, dear. You'll start me off again. You know you're welcome to come and stay with us for a while if you want.
No, thank you. I'm not really in the mood for any company at the moment. Will you be all right?
Oh, of course, dear. I'm a survivor. Everyone knows that. You call me if you need anything.
Adrienne patted Evangeline on the arm one last time, gathered up her children, and led them away. Robert finished checking that the seals on the mausoleum were secure again and came over to stand beside her. They stood awkwardly together, neither sure what to say. They'd never had anything in common except Finley, and they'd never felt the same way about him.
It was a nice service, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Shame about the weather.
Yes. I suppose it fits in a way.
That's true. Can I do anything for you?
Oh, thank you, but no. I just want to be alone right now. You don't feel insulted, do you?
Oh, no. I completely understand. I can't imagine what you're going through. I'll take care of everything. The vicar, the paperwork. Don't worry about a thing.
Thank you. And congratulations on your engagement to Constance Wolfe.
Oh, thank you.
They stood together a while longer, but neither of them could think of anything else to say. Robert finally bowed to her and walked away, taking the vicar with him, and they all felt a certain relief. Evangeline stood alone outside the stone mausoleum. Ugly, bloody place, but it was family, and it was probably what Finley would have wanted. It was still raining. Gray clouds for a gray day. Evangeline pulled the hood of her cloak a little forward to keep the rain out of her face. Her hands felt like someone else's, as though she were sleepwalking through what was left of her life. It wasn't as though she didn't have more than enough to keep her occupied. With Gregor dead, she'd been next in line to become head of Clan Shrek, but she'd had to decline that honor. It would have involved undergoing a gene test to prove her bloodline, and she couldn't do that. It would have revealed she was only the clone of the original murdered Evangeline, and that would have been a major scandal. It would also have made her a target for all kinds of fanatics from all sides of the political spectrum. A clone, successfully masquerading as the original, undetected for years, was high society's worst nightmare, an unacceptable affront. So she turned down the title and the massive inheritance that went with it, on the grounds that she wanted nothing from the despicable Gregor Shrek. People could understand that. Finley, much to her surprise, had been practical enough to make out a will and keep most of his affairs in order. He left everything to her. There was some money, enough to last several years if she was careful, and a few trunks of belongings that she would sort through when she was feeling stronger. Gray Shrek had agreed to become the new head of the family. It had to be her or Toby, and he wasn't interested. Evangeline approved of Grace in a distant sort of way. She was honest and straightforward, and she had the best interests of the family at heart. Pity about her politics, but you couldn't have everything. Besides, these days, Evangeline had her hands full with the Clone Underground. Even before Finley's death, she had become closely involved with clone politics, and many now looked to her for leadership and inspiration. Ever since the Clone Underground fought its way into mainstream politics, Divisions and corruption had become major problems, and Evangeline had dedicated herself to dealing with the infighting while keeping it strictly out of the public eye. She had more than enough work to keep her busy for years. If only she could convince herself that any of it mattered. She looked up at the closed stone door of the mausoleum.
Goodbye, Finley. May you find peace at last, my love. Sleep well until I come to join you.
She was living in a simple apartment in a modest area of the city. Not a very big place, but then it was only her. She unlocked the front door with her palm print and strode wearily in.
You have no messages.
Evangeline stood quietly in her hallway for a long moment, her cloak dripping steadily onto the ugly carpeting that had come with the furnishings. Her arms and legs felt heavy as lead, and it was an effort to hold her head up. She felt as if she could go to bed and sleep for a week, but she'd been sleeping far too much lately, so she wouldn't have to think or feel. And there was still work waiting to be done for the Clone Underground meeting tomorrow. She couldn't put it off any longer. She took off her rain-soaked cloak and hung it on the proper hook. Let it drip. It didn't matter. And only then did she realize there was someone else in the apartment with her. He was standing very still in the shadows at the far end of the room beyond, where the lights couldn't reach. She didn't waste time wondering which of her enemies had found her. There were too many. What mattered was that he had to be a professional to have got past the security systems, and she didn't have a weapon on her. She hadn't thought she'd need them at a funeral. Stupid, stupid. The kind of enemy she'd made had no respect for occasion. She was still looking about her for something she could use as a weapon when the figure stepped suddenly forward into the light, and her legs suddenly went weak at the knees.
Hello, Evie. You really should do something about your locks. Breaking in here was child's play.
Evangeline started forward and then stopped herself.
What? What are you? Some ghost come to haunt me? Or maybe some Esper hiding behind a mental mask? Or have I finally lost my mind and now see only the things I want to see?
None of the above. It's me, Evie. I made it out of Tower Shrek. A bit singed around the edges, but basically intact. After what I'd done to Gregor, I thought it best to go to ground for a while. I couldn't contact you. I didn't know who might be listening in. And then I heard I was dead and decided that might be best for everyone. Time for a new face and a new identity, I think. Make a new life for myself. With you. It was cruel of me to let you think I was dead, I know. But it was for the best, for both of us. Say you forgive me, Evie.
Of course I forgive you. I always do, don't I?
And in a moment, they were in each other's arms, hugging the breath out of each other. Tears finally ran down Evangeline's cheeks at her love returned, whole and real, and in her arms again. They finally loosened their grip and moved back a little to look into each other's eyes. They had parted on a quarrel and thought each other lost, but now they were back together again, and their love burned so fiercely in them they could scarcely breathe. Finley felt the need to calm things down a little and stepped back, still holding her hands in his. He glanced around at Evangeline's new lodgings.
Don't think much of your new place, Evie. Whoever owns it must have really pissed off his interior decorator. And what happened to your two friends in jars, Penny DiCarlo and Professor Wax?
They're at the main hospital waiting for their cloned bodies to stabilize so their heads can be grafted back. Wait, what does that matter? How the hell did you get out of Tower Shrek alive? And what did happen between you and my father?
I killed him. I killed him for you, for all the awful things he did to you. I took my time, making sure he suffered as you suffered. And when I finally sent him to hell, the fires of the pit must have seemed like a relief. Valentine Wolf was there, too. I shot him.
Hold everything. The wolf is dead?
Unfortunately, probably not. Though how he survived a point-blank disruptor blast is a mystery to me. After I was finished with Gregor, I discovered Valentine's body was no longer where it had fallen. Searching for him, I found the secret panel through which he'd escaped. It turned out to be a concealed passageway, no doubt prepared by Gregor for last-minute emergencies. I followed it to its end on a lower level, disguised myself in a dead guard's armor, and joined the other guards as they evacuated the burning tower. Then, I just walked away. No one stopped me, and I've been hiding out here and there ever since.
Evangeline let go of Finley's hands and stepped back.
We held your funeral today. Placed an empty coffin with your name on it in your family vault.
I know. I was watching. From a discreet distance. Not much of a turnout, was it? Good of Robert to come, though. We never could stand each other. And Addie and the kids, they should be all right. Addie was doing very well in stocks and shares, last I heard.
So, now you're officially dead. What next? A new life? Someone completely different from the old you?
Of course. It's not for the first time, after all. Finley Campbell had his day, but it's over now. Time to move on. With centralized records still in chaos after the rebellion, adopting a new identity is easy these days. Lots of people are doing it, for all kinds of reasons. And whereas Finley Campbell could never marry you, for all sorts of reasons, there's nothing to keep you and whoever I become apart. We can be together at last.
They hugged again, Evangeline burying her face in Finley's chest.
Won't you miss your old life?
Not really. Neither Finley Campbell nor the Masked Gladiator were ever really me. Just parts of me. Things I did to pass the time. And anyway, people never did appreciate what Finley Campbell did for them in the Rebellion. Not like Julian with his own hollow show.
He's dead, you know.
Yes, I know. Poor Julian. At rest, at last. At least he took that Chojiro bitch with him.
It's being presented as a lover's quarrel. The official line is he lost his mind when he discovered he was dying and wanted to take Bibi with him. The Chojiros went out of their way to say they didn't blame Julian. He was still very popular, after all. The whole city came to a standstill for his funeral.
I know. I was there. Standing in the crowd on the sidewalk as his funeral procession went by. Men and women were weeping openly. He was the people's hero. Not a legend like Owen or Jack Random or shadowy figures like you and me.
You shouldn't have gone. It was dangerous for you to appear in public. Julian would have understood.
I was disguised, and I couldn't let him go without saying goodbye. I never really had a friend before. He worshipped me, though I kept telling him not to. He could never understand how much I admired him. He was the real thing, an actual hero, fighting the good fight just because he believed in it. I was pushed into it. I only joined the underground so I could be close to you. Still, at least he got a good send-off. I was amazed to see his hollow show was still running, with an actor playing his part. Bigger audience share than ever. He tried once to set me up as a guest star, but apparently the networks considered me unsuitable material. How right they were. So, what are you doing with yourself these days, Evie? From what I've heard, you seem to be practically running the Clone Underground.
Someone has to. The previous leaders let their new power and money go to their heads. They squandered their influence and voice for backroom promises and generous bribes and achieved nothing. The clones should have been a major voice in the new administration, and by the time I'm finished, they will be. I got involved originally just to keep myself occupied, but you wouldn't believe the amount of corruption I uncovered. I couldn't go to the law. If word got out, it would discredit the whole clone movement. So I've been slowly cleaning out the rats from the inside and disposing of the bodies where no one will ever find them. You've come back from the dead at a very useful time, Finley. I can use a strong right arm.
When did you get to be so practical?
I had no choice. I was alone, and I suppose I had to grow up sometime. Losing my hated father and my dearest love on the same day convinced me I couldn't afford to be a child any longer.
I can't be seen with you publicly, not until we can find a body shop we can trust to change my face and body language.
You can wear a mask. You're used to that. We'll call you the Unknown Clone, a living symbol of all the clones who died to bring about clone equality. The movement can use a symbol like that.
Will I get to kill people?
Oh, lots.
Daniel Wolfe sat bolt upright in his bed, trying not to scream this time. The nightmare was already fading away as he tried to hang on to it, and he could no longer remember exactly what it was that had disturbed him so. But his body remembered. He was soaked in sweat, his heart hammering in his chest, and he was panting for breath as though he'd been running for his life. Perhaps he had been. He pushed the sweaty sheets aside.
Lights.
The light snapped on with reassuring speed, and his bedroom appeared around him. His old bedroom, from when he'd been a child, growing up in Tower Wolf. Stephanie had had it opened up again, especially for him, when it became clear how badly he needed somewhere he could feel safe and secure. Something had happened to him during his search for his dead father. Something awful. So bad, he couldn't remember any of it. Except in his dreams. He swung down from his bed and padded over to the nightstand to wash his face in the basin. The cool water was soothing, but he remained troubled. He felt sure there was something he ought to remember. Something important, no matter how much it terrified him. He spun around, arms raised to protect himself from something. But it was only his big sister, Stephanie, come to see that he was all right. She always knew when there was something wrong with him. She'd come straight from her own bed, her hair still disheveled, a cloak flung over her flimsy nightdress so as not to scandalize the guards. Daniel nodded jerkily to her and moved back to sit on the edge of his bed. She sat down beside him and put a comforting arm across his still shaking shoulders.
Oh, was it the dream again? Have you been taking the pills the doctor prescribed?
They don't help. I don't have any problem sleeping, just dreaming. No one can stop you from dreaming.
Do you have any idea what it is about the dream that's so bad, so frightening? Or why you keep having the same dream?
No. It's always gone by the time I'm properly awake.
Daniel stared down at his hands, twisting together in his lap. He was wearing pajamas with pictures of Bruin Bear on them, just as he had when he was still a child. They comforted him, and gave him some feeling that someone was looking after him.
It's just... something bad is coming. I know it. But I don't know what, or why, or how. I wish you'd call in an Esper. Have them dig it out of my head.
We've been through this before, Danny. If we call in an Esper, word would be bound to get out. And then people would talk. We can't have the other families or anyone else seeing us as weak. Not with things as they are. It's only a dream, Danny. You'll get over it.
If only I could remember.
Shh. Hush, Daniel. I'm here.
Stephanie took Daniel in her arms and rocked him back and forth a little. Daniel began to relax, almost in spite of himself. He remembered his mother doing the same thing when he was very young.
Don't worry about a stupid old dream. You're entitled to a few bad dreams after spending so long trapped in the wreckage of your ship. Just be grateful your transponder finally decided to start working again so we could track you down and pay for your transport home. Be glad you're still alive, Danny. A crash that bad would have killed most people.
Then why can't I remember anything about it? Why do I have no memories at all of why I crashed or what I was doing so near that deserted moon? I was gone for months. Where was I all that time?
It'll all come back. Give it time.
I don't know if I want to. I'm scared, Steph.
Look, try and tough it out for a while longer. If you're no better in a few weeks' time, I'll see about smuggling an Esper in here. There are still a few people who owed Clan Wolf favors. In the meantime, thank your lucky stars you crashed when you did. You were well on your way to the Forbidden Sector, and no one comes back from there.
So everyone keeps telling me. I wish I could have found Father. Or even just his body to bring it home to the family vault. I miss him so much, Steph.
I don't. He was a tyrant and a bully. Never cared for what we wanted, and far too ready to knock you about when it suited him. He never laid a hand on me. Knew damn well I'd stab him if he tried. We're much better off now he's gone. Valentine's disappeared. Constance is completely preoccupied with her forthcoming wedding, and I have secret allies. If we work this right, we could secure control of this family, Daniel, and run it as it should be run. Make us a power in the land again. Isn't that what we always wanted?
I suppose so. You always know best, Steph. You go on back to your room. He'll be all right now.
All right. Change into some fresh pajamas first. There's a clean pair in the cupboard. You go straight back to sleep, Daniel, and no more bad dreams.
Yes, Steph.
As she got up, she kissed him on the forehead, waggled her fingers in a goodbye, and left the room. And after a little while, Daniel stripped off his sweat-soaked pajamas. He left them lying on the floor, padded over to the cupboard, and put on a new pair. They smelled clean and fresh and safe. He started to get back into bed, and then grimaced at the feel and smell of the sweaty bedclothes. He got up again and clumsily remade the bed with new sheets and blankets. He couldn't have the servants do it. They would only have gossiped, but he still had his pride. He lay down again and pulled the sheet and blankets right up to his chin. The bright light hurt his tired eyes, but he didn't feel strong enough to turn the lights off yet. Maybe he never would. He scowled, suddenly angry with himself. He was a wolf, damn it. His father had raised him to be stronger than this. He opened his mouth to turn off the lights, and then stopped, as he suddenly realized he had another visitor. The door hadn't opened, and he hadn't heard or seen anyone approach, but nevertheless, he was no longer alone. Daniel sat up slowly in his bed, staring into the bright, mascara-red eyes of his older brother, Valentine. Valentine was sitting, or rather perching, on the end of Daniel's bed, hugging his knees to his chest, his pale face and dark, ringleted hair tilted a little to one side as he regarded his brother with fever-bright eyes. Dressed all in black, as always, he seemed like a giant crow or raven, a bird of ill omen. His scarlet mouth moved from a wide smile to a mock, disappointed pout as he studied his brother.
What's this, dear Daniel? No welcome home? No words of cheer at the return of the prodigal son?
How the hell did you get in here? How did you get past security and break in here without me noticing?
No one sees me anymore unless I want them to. I took the Esper drug, you see. And now I cloud the thoughts of mortal men as I walk unseen amongst them.
Daniel wondered if he dared reach for the gun he always kept under his pillow these days. Valentine didn't appear to be armed, but he was always dangerous.
What do you want, Valentine? What do you want with me at this ungodly hour?
To welcome you home, of course, and see you gathered safely back into the family fold. I can't come home again, you see. I've gone too far, seen too much, changed too much. But I retain a kind of nostalgia for the way things used to be, when I was younger and still merely human.
He fixed Daniel with his dark gaze.
I hear you're doing well for yourself, little brother. Constance, dear Constance, has given you control of the day-to-day running of the clan while she prepares for marriages and monarchy.
She needed someone. She's never trusted Stephanie.
How very wise. And you have been very outspoken since your return about the menace of Shub and the danger of Shub infiltrators. Why is that, do you suppose? You never showed any interest in public affairs before.
Daniel frowned.
I don't know. It just seems the right thing to do. And I have this feeling that Shub is a far greater threat than we know. That the Rogue AIs are up to something. Something awful.
You're doing very well. Everyone's very impressed with you. Chairing discussions, beefing up family security, getting involved in all kinds of things. Dear Daddy would be so proud of you. He was never proud of me. But then, I was never content to be just another wolf. I have made something much more dark and dangerous and very glamorous of myself, Daniel.
You made a deal with Shub when you were head of the family. Just how many of humanity's secrets did you sell to the rogue eyes of Shub? And what did you get in return?
More than you can imagine.
And I would have done far more, but events rather got away from me.
Who else in the clan worked with you? How far did the corruption go?
Oh, I worked alone, Daniel. I always have. I'm the only real black sheep of this family. I've never liked competition. If I'd ever seen you or our dear sister as serious competition, I'd have had you both strangled in your beds long ago. Ah, the happy, carefree days of youth. I almost miss them. Which is one of the reasons I'm here. To say goodbye to my youth, my past. I'm someone else now, bound on a journey to places you couldn't even imagine.
What the hell are you talking about, Valentine?
You never did have any patience, Daniel. Let me put it so simply, even you can't fail to understand me. I have joined with Shub. I will become as they are, powerful and immortal, riding an endless trip on unadulterated reality, the ultimate never-ending high. Oh, and along the way, I shall help to bring about the destruction of all humanity. Just because I can. And you'll help me do it, dear brother.
Never!
The point-blank energy blast punched right through Valentine's midriff and out his back. So suddenly his body barely rocked in its perch on the end of the bed. The smell of burnt meat was heavy on the air. Valentine bent slowly forward over his wound, almost as though bowing to his brother. Daniel felt a rush of excitement and achievement. In that moment, he felt as though he was destroying all that was dark and evil in Clan Wolf, cutting it out like a cancer. And then, impossibly, Valentine straightened up again. A wide hole had been burned through his shirt front by the energy beam, but there was no trace of a wound anywhere. He smiled his wide crimson smile, his eyes gleaming brightly against the surrounding black makeup. His pale face was ghostly, ghastly, demonic.
Nice try, Daniel. Didn't think you had it in you.
Dear Daddy would be proud. But the likes of you can't kill me anymore. Not after what I've been given. Finley Campbell tried the same thing in Tower Shrek. I told you I was immortal. Now, any last questions before I leave? I might even answer them, for old time's sake.
Daniel realized he was still pointing his disruptor at Valentine, and slowly lowered his arm. If he could keep Valentine talking, security had to have detected an energy gun discharging inside the tower.
Did you kill our father, Valentine?
Of course. He was in my way. Yours too, but I knew you and Stephanie would never find the guts to do what needed to be done. Jacob had gotten old. Worse, he'd got old-fashioned. He never saw the possibilities in a real alliance with Shub. And I never did care for him. He never cared for me.
You never gave him cause to.
I was his son, his firstborn, and his heir. And because I chose to follow my own path, rather than the one he'd chosen for me, he disowned me. So I disowned him with a blade in the back. And soon, I will disown all humanity.
That's it. Everything you've done, all the people you've killed and mean to kill, just because Daddy didn't love you enough. You pitiful long streak of piss!
I know why you've been having nightmares, little brother. I know where you went and what you saw. If you'd asked me nicely, I might even have told you. But now, I'll just leave you to your night sweats and your desperate dreams. And I shall take great delight in seeing your face when your nightmare embraces all humanity. Give my love to Steph, but no tongues. We are family after all.
And then he was gone. Daniel tried to control his whirling thoughts. Everyone knew Shub had remote control teleportation. That's how they'd got past the quarantine and broken out of the Forbidden Sector undetected. So for once, Valentine was probably telling the truth about his new allies. And maybe he did know what had happened to Daniel's quest to find his dead father. Daniel decided it was time to do what was necessary, and to hell with the consequences. He had to find a telepath, an Esper powerful enough to dig into his mind and find the truth, before his nightmare became humanity's.
Hazel Dark lay on her back, strapped down on a moving trolley as it trundled along endless stone corridors. The trolley ran fairly smoothly, but it was constantly being jerked this way and that as she was transported down one narrow passage after another. She felt deathly tired, and her body seemed weighed down by far more than the half dozen leather straps holding her in place. Her thoughts were slow and drifting, and it seemed to her that they had been for some time now. Head first, strapped down, the trolley carried her on into the gloom, and it was hard for her to care where or why. Suddenly, there were people moving around her, passing silently back and forth without looking at her. They were all tall, willowy albinos with glaring, blood-red eyes, wearing long robes of bright, swirling colors, and their long, bony faces were covered with vicious ritual scars and wild, jagged patterns. The patterns were different on every face, stylized as a clown's makeup. The trolley slowed for a moment, so two of the ghostly figures could talk over her helpless body. It slowly came to Hazel that she knew these people. They were the Bloodrunners, an old, old culture, a separate branch of humanity, isolated by its own wishes in the forbidden Obia systems. It was said they had a hand in every dirty and illegal trade in the Empire, and no one was strong enough to deny them their filthy tithe. It was further said, in quiet, furtive whispers, that they traded in these things only to fund their never-ending experiments into suffering and death and immortality. To the Bloodrunners, humanity was nothing more than so many lab animals, specimens to be tested and destroyed and discarded as necessary. No one raised any objections, even in the highest circles of Empire. No one dared. And Hazel Dark had fallen into their hands. Fear moved through her like a slow poison, spurring her awake. Her thoughts began to clear for the first time in what seemed like a long time. She remembered the mission on Lacrimae Christi, remembered Owen trying desperately to warn her, and then a shimmering silver energy screen closing in around her. The Bloodrunners had snatched her away from Owen, and there'd been nothing either of them could do to prevent it. When the Bloodrunners finally lowered the energy field, she fought them fiercely, but they did something to her body and her mind. And for a long time now, she had drifted in dark and uneasy dreams. She had some vague recollection of great white faces looming over her, saying she was no use to them without her powers. They would wait till she was restored, and then begin their investigations. She tried to remember what these powers might be, or how she might use them against her captors. But thinking was still so hard. Sleep tugged at the corners of her mind, and it took all she had to fight it off. The trolley took a sharp right turn into yet another stone corridor. Hazel had no idea how long she'd been moving, or where she might be going. She was afraid, but it was a vague, unfocused fear as yet. She made herself concentrate on her surroundings, focusing on them to help focus her mind. The ceiling above her was solid gray stone, pitted and darkened by untold ages. The walls on either side of her were built from massive blocks of the same gray stone, fitted neatly together without trace of mortar. Human arms projected from the walls here and there, as though thrust through from the other side. They held up blazing torches in dull clay holders. The flames flickered constantly, as though troubled by subtle disturbances in the air. The arms never moved, and the fingers that curled around the clay holders were still as death. It was cold in the corridor, and the air had an old, dusty smell. Hazel tried to move against the straps holding her down, but they were too tight. She was helpless, and alone, and in the hands of her enemies. The trolley finally lurched to a halt in a wide stone chamber. Without moving her head, she tried to take in as much of her new surroundings as possible. The walls and the low ceiling of the chamber had been constructed from the same gravestone, unrelieved by any adornment save the living torch holders. And then she caught her breath sharply as she saw a severed human head standing on a dull pewter pedestal. It was still alive and aware. The skin had a normal hue, but the top half of the head and skull had been removed, sawed cleanly away above the eyebrows, so that the upper brain tissues were exposed, pale and glistening in the torchlight. Delicate metal filaments protruded from the naked tissues with sparks of light coming and going at their tips. The mouth trembled slightly, as though always on the edge of speaking, and the eyes were sharp and clear, and suffering, and horribly sane.
Don't mind him. That's just my oracle, a repository of information and deduction, far superior to your computers.
Hazel let her head roll slowly to one side, pretending to be weaker than she was. A blood runner was standing at her side, a vicious white specter in gaudy robes. And yet, there was something familiar about the face, or perhaps rather the scars on the face. Hazel suddenly remembered where she'd seen this blood runner before, and a cold hand gripped her heart like a fist.
Scour.
That's right, Hazel Dark. I came for you once before, in the old standing of the Deathstalker, but you eluded me.
You're dead. Owen killed you. I saw you die.
Bloodrunners don't stay dead. We've moved beyond that. We've lived for centuries, and death has no power over us anymore. We're an old culture, Hazel, older than your empire. It's been a long time since we saw anything new. Anything like you, dear Hazel. We're going to learn so much from you.
I don't have a damn thing to say to you, Bloodrunner. I don't care what kind of a deal my old captain made with you people when I served on the Shard. I don't owe you anything.
Everyone talks eventually. Let me show you the previous occupant of this chamber. He was so sure of himself when he first came here, so delightfully full of defiance, just like you. Swore he'd die before he broke, but we wouldn't allow him that option.
Scour took hold of the end of the trolley with his large white hands. The fingers were long and slender, like a surgeon's or an artist's. The trolley spun sharply around, briefly disturbing Hazel's stomach, and when it stopped, Hazel was facing the other end of the chamber. Scour moved unhurriedly around to stand beside her, and then gently lifted her head so that she could see. And there, pinned to the gray stone wall by great brass staples in his hands and arms, hung what remained of a man. His face was untouched, dominated by wild, staring eyes. But beneath that, he'd been gutted from chin to groin, cut open in a perfectly straight line, the skin pulled back and pinned to the wall in wide pink flaps. His internal organs were gone. Instead, lengths of transparent tubing plunged into the great crimson cavity where his guts had been. Some of them twined between and around his exposed ribs like obscene ivy, feeding him slow-moving liquids and draining off others. They pulsed slowly, and the man's whole body shook gently in time to that ghastly rhythm. His genitals were gone, the gap plugged with a simple metal plate. Blood had run down his dangling legs from the terrible wounds long ago, and had never been cleaned off.
He was so very brave, but bravery isn't enough here. All that matters now is how useful you can be to us. And this specimen's use is at an end.
He let Hazel's head fall back under the trolley painfully and strolled over to the hanging man. Hazel forced her head up again, just in time to see Scour grab a handful of the transparent tubing and rip it out. The man's whole body convulsed. Fluids ran from the ends of the tubing and pooled on the floor. Blood and something else gushed from the man's mouth, and then the life went out of his eyes, and his head fell forward. The arms and legs still twitched, but he was obviously dead. Scour let the tubing drop carelessly to the floor.
Is that supposed to impress me?
No, it's supposed to scare you. Fear is your friend here. It will help you make the inevitable transition from living legend to laboratory specimen. You will break eventually. Everyone does. Better to get it over with quickly, while most of your sanity remains. Ah, Hazel, the things we shall learn from you. as we become intimate with your flesh and blood and bone, your every depth of body and mind.
Trying to buy time for her powers to return, Hazel decided to strike up a conversation.
Tell you what, let's make it an exchange. You tell me all about yourself, about the Blood Runners, and I'll tell you all about me. The things I can do that you don't know about. A trade, and no one needs to get hurt.
It's been a very long time since I could speak of our origins with anyone who could hope to understand and appreciate them. After all, dear Hazel, you're no more human than we are anymore. Listen and learn as I tell you the true and terrible history of the Blood Runners.
A headless human body strode into the chamber, carrying a simple wooden chair before it. The skin between the shoulders was perfectly smooth, as though the well-muscled body had never had a neck or a head, nor ever felt a need for them. It came to a halt beside the trolley and set the chair down gently. Scour sat on it, arranging his robes comfortably. The headless body turned and left. It didn't seem to need a head to see where it was going.
Just a servant. Our will moves them, and nothing else. Think of them as meat machines. Our tech has taken a different turn. Our wonders derive from the endless capacities of the human body and mind, not the cold metals and crystals of your limited tech. Now, where shall I begin? With the Summer Stone, perhaps? No. Further back than that. You need to appreciate how old we are, how unspeakably ancient. Before the Empire was, we were. Before humanity spread itself across the many worlds, we were already old. Separate even then, though only human, following our own hidden ways. When humanity went to the stars, we found a world for ourselves. Centuries passed as we remade ourselves in our desired image. Not like the Hayden men with their limiting reliance on tech, but through genetic engineering and body sculpting. Where humanity dared not go, we went gladly, ignoring all restraints. We dreamed the impossible and made it real in flesh and blood and bone. We became long-lived, vastly improved hermaphrodites. We lost the ability to make children, but we wanted to live forever in our own flesh, not our offspring's. I was alive then, as all who live then are alive now. Not in this body, admittedly. Our identities live on in the mind pool, passing from one body to another down the long centuries. As one body wears out, I leave it to die, transfer my consciousness into the mind pool, and then download myself back into the new body I had prepared previously. That's why we wear the ritual scars on our faces. They identify the inhabitant of the body. Flesh is finite. But we go on forever.
What happens to the minds and souls of the new bodies you create?
We drive them out. Newborn souls are no match for minds that have endured for centuries.
That's how you survived Owen's attack. You just moved on into another body.
Of course. We are always prepared. The extent of his power surprised us, so we decided to wait and watch till you had temporarily exhausted your powers, and then pressed our claim to you again. You belong to us, Hazeldark, and we will have our pound of flesh, and more besides. Don't wait for Owen to come and rescue you. No one can come to where we are without our permission. The Obeah systems are more a state of mind than a state of matter.
Power source. You must have some kind of power source to fuel your science and maintain the mind pool. The Summer Stone?
Very good, Hazel. You're almost fully awake now. Yes, the Summerstone helped make us what we are today. It maintains our existence, defends us from our enemies, ensures our survival. All our power to create and destroy has its heart there. Would you like to see it?
He gestured with one hand, and a great slab of stone was suddenly standing at the foot of the trolley. Hazel lifted her head to see it better. A great conical shape of solid stone, gray and pitted, it was roughly 8 feet in diameter, and its tip touched the ceiling of the chamber. It looked like it weighed tons, and Hazel was vaguely surprised the floor didn't crack under its weight. It looked solid and very dense, realer than real, and strangely, hauntingly familiar.
Do you recognize it?
No. Where did you find it?
The same place you did. On a planet once known as Hayden, and before that, the Wolfling world. What you're looking at was once part of the Madness Maze. We stole it and brought it here.
Scour gestured, and the stone disappeared. Hazel let her head drop back onto the trolley, her thoughts churning.
That piece of rock was once part of the Madness Maze, but...
Yes, yes, I know. You saw a high-tech structure. But the maze's appearance is largely dictated by the minds of those who discover it. You expected to see an alien artifact, so that's what you saw. We think in older terms, so we saw a ring of standing stones, a henge. It took us a long time to understand what it was and what it could do, and in the end, we were driven from that world before we could pierce its heart, as you did. But we took one stone with us, and it has sustained us ever since. Perhaps now you'll begin to understand why we are so eager to learn the secrets of your flesh and of your mind, to understand what marvelous changes the maze has wrought in you. The maze is gone. Destroyed. You are all that remains of its glory and its mystery. We will know your secrets. We deserve them. You are what we were meant to be.
Hazel considered the possibilities of blood runners with maze powers, and her blood ran cold. She surged up against the leather straps holding her down, channeling all her will into calling up her boost, and sudden new strength flooded through her. The leather straps held, but the buckles gave way. She sat up quickly, throwing aside the loosened straps, and jumped down from the trolley, careful to put it between her and Scour. Her legs were only unsteady for a moment. Her mind was crystal clear, and already working furiously on how to get past Scour to the only exit from the chamber. Her hands dropped automatically to her sides, but her guns and her sword were gone, of course. It didn't matter. She was boosting, and strong enough and mad enough to handle one scrawny bloodrunner. She pushed the trolley aside. Scour hadn't moved an inch, his face entirely unmoved.
Get back on the trolley, Hazel. There's nowhere you can go. Your life is over. Your destiny ends here with us.
Oh, cram it! I'll see every one of you dead before I let you lay one finger on me! Even if I have to dismantle you one at a time with my bare hands! Now you can either show me the way out of this hellhole, or I'll start with you.
There is no way out. This is all there is. And you're not going anywhere.
Scour raised a pale hand, and a shimmering force field sprang up between him and Hazel. It moved slowly toward her, and she backed uneasily away. She tried to make a dart for the open doorway, but another force field appeared out of nowhere to block her way. It advanced on her too, and Hazel backed away again, looking quickly about her. In her boosted state, she was potentially very fast on her feet, but there just wasn't enough room to build up any speed. The two crackling energy fields hemmed her in and herded her back to the trolley. Hazel dropped out of boost. No point in burning up what little strength she had left. Scour smiled at her.
This is our world, Hazel. Our place. And we are very powerful here. Now, be a good little lab specimen and lie back down on the trolley, and we can make a start on your long journey into pain and self-knowledge.
He held up one pale hand, and there was something shiny in it. A scalpel.
We're going to have Such fun together, Hazel.
That's enough, Scour. This was not agreed. She belongs to all of us.
Hazel looked quickly around, hoping against hope for a last-minute rescue, or at least a breathing space. A second Bloodrunner was standing in the open doorway, his left hand held up in protest or warning. Two of the headless bodies stood behind him, muscular arms crossed over their immense chests.
Still afraid to travel anywhere without your bodyguards, Lament. It was decided that Hazel Dark should be placed into my hands, that I should have first access to the mysteries of her flesh. I have the most experience in these matters.
That's a matter of opinion. And not all of us agreed with that decision. You are too secretive, Scour. You keep too many things to yourself these days. The secrets contained in Hazel Dark's mind and body are too precious, too important to us all, to be trusted only to you. I speak for many. Do not defy us.
I have allies too, Lament. There are many who owe me favors. Many who would come when I called.
But are you ready to risk open war in the corridors, Scour? Many of us are. Hazel Dark could be the key that finally opens our long-delayed potential. With what we learned from her, we could become gods of the whole Empire, rather than just this place.
Don't I get a say in this? If I was just offered a little civilized consideration, I might well cooperate with what you want.
I doubt that. Not with what we intend to do to you.
What do you want, Lament?
There is a gathering at the Summerstone. All the Blood Runners. We want Hazel Dark brought to the Summerstone to see what effect it has on her and her on it.
That's dangerous. Too many unknowns. Too much out of our control. What if she regains her full powers?
What if she does? She is one, and we are many. And this is our place of power. Nothing happens here without our consent. You know that.
True. Very well. She goes to the Summerstone.
Scour turned his blood-red eyes on Hazel, and she had to fight down an instinctive need to fall back a pace.
If nothing else, it should be interesting to see what you make of the Summerstone and what it makes of you.